Okay?
Yeah. 2 minutes. Good evening, my friends. Tonight's lecture concerns itself with Rabbi Alexander Shlomo Rosenberg. There is a verse in Koheles in which Shlomo HaMelech says, "Ir ktano v'anoshim bo ma'ot," that there is a small city and it has few people in the city, "Uvo aleo melech godo," and a great king comes to make war on this city, "he surrounds the city," "uvono aleo mitzodim gedolim," and he built great siege works, so the city's going to collapse. "Umotzo bo ish miskein chochom," and in the city was a very, very wise man who is seemingly poor in material goods. "Umilatu esoir bechochmoso," and in his wisdom, he was able to save the whole city. "Ve'odom lo zochar esoish ha'miskeinahu," but people don't know him, are not reminded of him, have very little memory of him, even though he's the one who saved the city. So Shlomo HaMelech here constructs for us an image of a person of greatness who accomplishes wonders, but does so in a way that he is little recalled, he's not remembered, he's not appreciated. So I thought of this posuk when I began to formulate what I want to say about Rabbi Rosenberg. If there's kashrus in the world today, standards of kashrus, it's thanks to one individual, Rabbi Alexander S. Rosenberg. Rosenberg was a Rav in the United States, in Yonkers, New York. He was a Hungarian in all the positive traits that those people have, and he had none of the other traits. He was an aristocrat in his bearing, in his appearance, in his speech, and he was one clever person, great clever person. Now, I got to know him when I was a rabbi in Miami Beach. This entire series I mentioned before, it's not biographical, it's anecdotal. It's my reminiscences. And therefore, if I omit things that people think should have been said, well, that's because it didn't happen to me. I can only tell you my reminiscences. I came to Miami Beach as a rabbi, so in those years, there were kosher hotels in Miami Beach. There were three rather large hotels that were under the supervision of the OU, of the Kosher's division of the Orthodox Union. And Rabbi Rosenberg was the rabbinic administrator of the Kosher's division of the OU. And I remember that he came down to Florida at the beginning of the season to check out the hotels. And I was sitting in my office in Shul one day, and I received a call, and on the other end of the line is this mellifluous, beautiful voice. And he says, "Rabbi Wein," he said, "would you like to meet me?" And I said, "Well, who are you?" And he said, "My name is Rosenberg." He said, "And I have something to do with the hotels here. And I want to talk to you because I want to give you an assignment." So I said, "Well," I still didn't put two and two together. I didn't know Rabbi Rosenberg. I never met him before. I didn't even realize he was the head of the OU. And the fact that all three hotels were owned by members of my shul certainly was not advantageous to me. But he said he'd like to meet me, so I met him in the lobby of a hotel, and here comes this Jew with a magnificent trimmed white beard, and he had a great black Hamburg on his head. He never took off his hat. I always accused him of sleeping in it. I never saw him without his hat. And I remember once I went with him to Procter & Gamble, which we'll talk about later, a major food company in the United States, one of the largest food companies in the world. And we were having a meeting with the vice president regarding something, and it was a cold day in Cincinnati, and so we had overcoats. So when we came in, his secretary took our overcoats, and she said, "May I take your hat?" And I gave her my hat, you know. But Rosenberg said, "You could have everything, my dear, but not my hat." And he never took off his hat. And it gave him an advantage over everybody else in the room. I didn't figure it out later. But he's sitting in his crown, and the other people are already not as aristocratic or powerful as he is. So I sat down in the lobby with him, and he said, "Rabbi Wein," he said, "I'm going to give you an assignment. You're going to be in charge of the kosheris in these three hotels." And he said, "And I'm going to give you a short course in kashrus." He said, "Not in Yoredeya, not in the laws of kashrus, but in what really happens in the field, so that you'll be prepared to execute the assignment correctly." And he said, "One of the first rules is, don't call me. If I assign you, I don't want to be bothered. That's why I picked you." He said, "There are 6-7 other rabbis here in Miami Beach, but I picked you." And Rosenberg was someone that you really constitutionally were unable to say no to. And well, that was his power, not just with little shrimp rabbis like me starting out. He was decades my senior and greater and everything. But that was the way the vice president of Procter & Gamble couldn't say no to him. No one could say no to him. And that was a talent unbelievable. Before we get into the kashrus, I want to give you a little background. So I became friends of, really, he was my mentor. In the back of my mind, I always suspected that he thought that I was going to be his successor, which I was. Because after he passed away, suddenly I was impressed into the job, and for 5 years I was the head of the OU until I finally was paroled. So we became friends. He would come down to Miami. He'd stay 2 weeks. And every day I found time to go over and talk to him because he was really one of the most fascinating human beings I ever met. In 1945, at the end of the Second World War, he is he's attached to the United States Army. I never got out of him whether he really was in the Army or he was just attached to the Army. I believe that he was a representative of the Vat Ha'atzola from the United States that sent a certain number of rabbis to Europe to try and help the survivors of the Holocaust. So he tells me a story that there's no kosher shechita for 250,000 Jews in the German DP camps. So he says the truth is that out of the 250,000 Jews, there were maybe 2,000 that wanted to have shechita. He said there were those that opposed me, those that said we don't want that, because he said people were so angry at God, he said it was palpable. And he said many of those people later were Chassidish Rabbeim in New York. But I set up, he said, the first shechita in Germany after the war for those that were in the DP camps. He said, how can you set up shechita? There wasn't one building in Germany standing. The Allies had destroyed everything. Hitler got, they wreaked vengeance. So he has to have a building built, an abattoir, a slaughterhouse. So he said to me, he said, Rabbi Wein, I wish I could imitate his voice was magic. He said, if you want to have anything done, never speak to the clerk. You have to speak to someone in great authority. So he said, I went to speak to General Patton. Now Patton, as Rosenberg put it, disliked Jews. He felt that they were pushy. And he said, so I pushed him. And I explained to him about kosher meat and that we have to have this special place built and we need an abattoir. And I said, if you're able to do this for me, General, you will see that you will solve a lot of problems that otherwise you'll have with the displaced persons, with the refugees. He said, they're a very unhappy lot, and we have to try and restore them to some sense of normalcy, and the Jews have to have kosher meat. He didn't tell them that most of the Jews didn't want kosher meat, and that he was only doing it for a minority, etc. He didn't tell them any of that. He told them he needs it. Patton, who had the foulest mouth in the American Army, swore at him, cursed him. And I'm in a shul, so I can't give it over in its full flavor. But Rosenberg was so charming, he said, I was afraid because Patton always had two guns in his holster, at his belt. And he gave me the abattoir. He ordered it done, and it was done. And we shechted, and we had kosher meat. And he said, in the DP camps, I got to meet and know many of the people who later would become leaders in the Jewish community, and especially in the Hasidic community. And they remembered Rosenberg, and he remembered them. He had such a soft spot for them. If a person was a Holocaust survivor, he almost waived all the rules. He bent over backwards to help them. His greatest enjoyment in life, he told me, was that he would go Chol HaMoed Sukkos or Chol HaMoed Pesach to Williamsburg in New York. You know, there were a Spinker Chassidim and a Satmar Chassidim, the Chassidish neighborhood in Brooklyn. And he said, I would stand on the street corner and they're wheeling buggies full of children, and everybody is dressed up for Yontif. And he said, I wept, but it was tears of joy. I never thought that I would be able. He said they were skeletons. Not only skeletons physically, but skeletons spiritually. Everything was gone from them. So Rosenberg, I found out later when I became the head of the OU, we had a lot of mashgichim that worked for us, a lot of kashrut supervisors. And when I was there, there were over 750. Today it's an enormous thing. The OU has grown much greater, especially since I left. I think that's the cause. And the but we had a number of people that were superfluous in a world where everybody is downsized and where companies are efficient. It was a little less than efficient. Like, we had three guys watching them make Tide soap. Now, there's nothing non-kosher in Tide soap. I'll discuss later how we got Tide soap to have the OU on it. Nobody eats Tide soap, at least. I mean, if you rinse out your laundry, at least, nobody eats Tide soap. And he had three guys working there. But all of them were Holocaust survivors. And he convinced Procter & Gamble that Tide soap requires stringent supervision. And not only that, he convinced them, and it may be true. Well, I'll tell you a few other incidents that he told me, because he believed it. He said to them, listen, if you're good to the Jews and you're good to the OU, he said, your business will prosper. And they believed in him like a rebbe. If Rosenberg said it, then it was straight from heaven. The goyim, they didn't know what to do with him. There was a company, Coffee Rich, the parve, the non-dairy creamer. So there was a guy, there was a real man by the name of Rich. And he lived in Buffalo. He owned the Buffalo Bills football team. The stadium was named Rich Stadium. So this was a very important item to have a non-dairy creamer, very, very important item. And Rosenberg negotiated it with him. So he told me the story. He said, he told Rich, he said, listen, if you have the OU, God will help you. It'll be successful. So Rich said, okay, I'll put on the OU. And he put it on big, like you could really, everybody else puts the OU that you need a microscope to see it. I'll discuss why in a minute. But Rich put it on, you could really see it. And his business zoomed. Every quarter It doubled, it tripled in the amount of Don Dairy Creamer, and then he made Rich Whip, and they. So Rosenberg went to him and he said, you want to really be successful? He said, put parve on it. He said, what's parve? So he said, no, you put in these words, P-A-R-E-V-E, under the O-U. And Rich said, if the rabbi says it, he called in his designers immediately, and they redesigned the package, and it says parva on it till this day, and Rich became, like it quadrupled again, and the Buffalo Bills started to win football games, and he believed in Rosenberg more than a chassid believes in a rebbe. And that was Rosenberg. He could do it. Because he said to me, he said, well, if you don't put parve on there, nobody, everybody will say, it's the OU, but it, maybe it's dairy. Maybe they make it in dairy. Maybe they look at it in dairy. Maybe, you know, maybe somebody's drinking milk next door. So you got to put parve on it. And he did so. You know, he had remarkable feats of being able to do so. Now, the OU, you have to have a little history of the background of kashrus in America, which is a sad story. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, who was the first and only chief rabbi of New York and who came to America at the turn of the 20th century, I think in 1900 he came, so he ran into enormous kashrus problems with the butchers, with the meat purveyors, with criminals, with everything. And because it was chaotic, America was the Wild West, at least Jewish America certainly was. And Rabbi Yaakov Yosef died of aggravation. He got a stroke and he died of aggravation. They killed him, literally killed him. And in America, there was absolutely no one standard of kashrus. And rabbis, individual rabbis, granted kashrus certifications. And you have to understand their position also. Many times that was the only way they could make a living. But that is subject to pressures, even sometimes subject to corruption. And it was very hard. People say it was difficult to be a Sabbath observer, to be a Shomer Shabbat. It was difficult to be a kosher Jew. For instance, there was no shortening in America. I remember my mother, blessed memory, she used to collect chicken fat, right? We used to start now, Hanukkah time, to collect chicken fat so we would have the fat for Pesach. Cholesterol heaven. And then they used to say, well, maybe spry is kosher because it said all vegetable oil. But all vegetable oil didn't mean that it was all vegetable oil, because under the federal law then, it was possible to have a certain percentage of animal fat and still call it all vegetable oil. And because of the fact that a shortening is considered to be the catalyst, it's the Dover Hamamid, it's the basic product, so therefore it does not become nullified even in a million. So you didn't know what to do. Rosenberg took over, they hired him to be in the late 1930s, they hired him to be, the OU had always a kosher department, but it was very small. And it was really insignificant. And when he took it over in the late 1930s, and then in the Second World War, his first thing, he went to Procter & Gamble. Again, his idea always was that you were going to get the major companies. If you got the major food companies in America to do it, then you would have kashrus in America. If you got the little guy to do it, the Hamish guy, that would never do it. Because he did not have the capital, he didn't have the resources, he didn't have the plan, he couldn't do it on a mass basis. So he went to Procter & Gamble, he told me he met with the vice president, and he said to him, you have a shortening called Crisco. And I would like to make certain that it's kosher, and then we will certify it for you. And Procter & Gamble allowed him to check everything. And Crisco was 100% kosher. And it was the first real breakthrough of the OU. Because now you had a kosher shortening that you could buy on the shelf in any store, in any supermarket, in any grocery store. And he developed a relationship with this vice president. I'll speak about it at the end, a story about him with advice. But he told me that he cultivated him. He would call him at least once a week. He would discuss things. The man confided in him. He helped him in his marriage. He gave him advice. He became his guru. And the vice president said, well, maybe we have other products that could have the OU. And Procter & Gamble developed into an enormous field for kosher products. I remember that when I was the head of the OU, so Procter & Gamble made the cake mixes. Duncan Hines, we were able to make it kosher under the OU, and that was a tremendous job because in the cake mix there's like 200, 300 suppliers. So you have to check every supplier. It's not just the end product. You have to know where the supplier is. So when we finally put it through, he told me, he said, that's wonderful. He said, Rabbi Rosenberg worked on this for 5-6 years and I wasn't able to satisfy him. I'm so happy that I'm able to satisfy him now, that I'm able to have a kosher cake mix. So I asked him straight out, because I didn't know anything. I said, you know, it's wonderful and we appreciate it and great. And I didn't tell him, but he's really financing the whole OU. I said, why are you so interested to have kosher Duncan Hines? You know, because in the whole world, how many people are really standing in line to buy kosher Duncan Hines cake mixes? How big was the Orthodox? You know, we live in a time where we think, you know, 50 million Orthodox Jews are buying things. But in the real market, it's really a trickle. It's nothing. So why are you interested? So he said, well, I'll tell you the secret of marketing, which he said, Rabbi Rosenberg explained to me. What's the secret of marketing? And it's really brilliant. He said, the whole grocery business depends upon shelf space. Where they put the product, where does the store put the product? If they put you all the way on the bottom, you're not going to sell. And if they put you all the way on top that you need a ladder to get it, you're not going to sell. So they have to put you at eye level in the center. So he said, so why do they do that? The store does it for things that sell, right? So you'll notice that in the United States, Kellogg's cereal is always in the best place. Coca-Cola is always in the best place. You know, if you want to buy a different off-brand or a store brand, you got to go looking at the bottom shelves. They're not there at eye level. So he said, Rosenberg explained to me that there are 15 or 20 markets in the United States where Orthodox Jews can make a difference. So we experimented, he said. We put the OU, and because of the OU, we went to those 15, 20 markets, like in Brooklyn, or in the north side of Chicago, or the Jewish neighborhoods in Detroit and Cleveland. And they put us, because of that, they put us in a better shelf space than there was, because the main cake mix was Betty Crocker. It wasn't Duncan Hines. So Betty Crocker was always in the middle. Duncan Hines on the bottom. They always only have 15% of the market. But now that they moved us to better shelf space because there were Jews in the neighborhood, so the non-Jews also bought it. So he said our sales went up 40% in 2 months. Not because Jews bought the cake mix, but because of the fact that the OU was a catalyst to get them to have better shelf space. So it's a complicated world. It's never the way it appears. There always are other factors that are involved, and Rosenberg was wise enough to know that. Now, he saw this great chaos. He kept on telling me that the situation, I would tell him, like, the hotel orders something. I said, the only supplier has this and this hechsher, and you don't recognize this hechsher. What am I supposed to do? And so he advised me, you know, he said on certain products, really don't need a hechsher. So you can certainly use it there. But he said on certain products, when it is critical to have proper supervision, you cannot use it. So I explained to him that there was a certain product that every bakery needed. And this product was not under the OU. And this product had what he called a questionable hechsher. So I said to him, Rabbi Rosenberg, what are we going to do here? So he said, well, for a month, you'll have to tell them that they can't bake with this product. They're going to bake with a substitute that's not as good, but that we have no choice. But he said, I hope it'll be resolved in a month. I didn't know what he meant by that. He called me up one day and he said, now you can use the product. I said, what happened? He said, we bought him out. He bought out the rabbi that was giving the hechsher. Paid him. Bought him out. And raised it to OU standards without changing the price to the company. And his goal was that there should be kashrus. And therefore, it isn't that he ever begrudged anyone anything if it would contribute to his goal. He had an idea, for instance, he explained it to me many times, that I once questioned him why the OU has a hechsher on, I mentioned Tide detergent, on all the soaps and on toothpaste, and all sorts of things that, you know, plastic bags, aluminum foil. So he said, well, that allows us to give a hechsher on chickens and on matzah. I said, what do you mean? He said, listen, Empire, and he's the one who set up Empire as the kosher chicken producer, and without Empire, there wouldn't be chickens in America. So he said, we have a staff there, and when I was there, we had a staff of over 35 people. He said, it's impossible for them to pay the 35 people all by themselves, because they're running a profit-making business. So it's not only that we don't get paid from them, we have to subsidize them. He said, how can we subsidize them? We never have any money. He said, Procter & Gamble subsidizes them. When we get money from Procter & Gamble or Palmolive on the soaps and on all the things, it costs us very little to have any sort of certification there. And the money that we get from there, we're able to see to it that there should be kosher chickens in America. He had that kind of a vision. And the same thing with matzahs. We had a hechsher on, I think it was Horitz Margareten then. Today, there's only, I think, one matzah company left in America that owns all the names. But then it was Horitz Margareten. So, you have to put in a lot of mashgichim in a matzah factory. You have to watch every place on the line to make sure that it doesn't become a breakdown, that it shouldn't take longer than the 18 minutes, etc., etc. And the matzah company can't afford that. So therefore, he put in people, and it was subsidized on the basis of the fact that they were able to have money from other certifications that didn't meet that, didn't require that kind of supervision. So he had that genius in him, and he had that quality that he saw everything. He saw the long picture, the great picture, not just the short item or the one thing that was involved. Kashrus is a business that is fraught with political pressures. There's a lot of money involved. There are jobs involved. It's a very, very difficult field. It's a minefield to be able to navigate it correctly. And he was a master at it, just a master. He would attend meetings of the rabbinical organizations, and everybody was lying in wait for him. I remember I used to, once in a while, I would attend the meetings also before I became the head. And he would field every question with aplomb. When people questioned, what happened was that many of the Chassidish Hechsherim, or the Hamish Hechsherim, super kosher Hechsherim, all had the OU. They had their own Hechsher besides, but they all had the OU. And their main business was based upon the fact that the OU was not reliable. That was the publicity. If you want to have real kosher oil for Pesach, you cannot buy the OU oil, you got to buy our oil. But what they neglected to say is that they bought the oil from an OU plant, because the small guy cannot produce it. The only thing he can do is they'll put his label on a special production. But you were talking enormous sums of money to create factories. And Rabbi Rosenberg, in his genius, controlled all the basic factories. If you wanted to buy glycerin in America, you have to buy it from an OU plant. And without glycerin, you can't make shortening. So all the shortenings are OU shortenings. So it doesn't make any difference what it says on the label or what the people say. Oh, you can't trust them. Because at the end of the day, that's what you're eating. And the same thing was true in the poultry plants, where Empire produced for many, many different labels. And many of the labels advertised that you can't trust Empire chickens, because that's how you further your own business. Anybody else would have become cynical. Would have somehow would have defended it. He told me many times, I don't say a word. Doesn't bother me a bit. He said, these people are making a living. He said, let them make a living. Why should Procter & Gamble make all the money? They let them also make a living. And my interest is only that it should be kosher. And it's kosher, so then what do I care? In a world where everybody defends their turf, where nobody is willing to admit that the other person somehow has a right even to be in the business, so to speak, he was above all of that. And he told it to me over and over again. He said, never, never, never. So he told it to me regarding rabbis, because rabbis also have that problem. You're in a town with 6-7 rabbis. I'm the greatest rabbi in town. Why should the other guys even exist? And sometimes the other rabbis don't have nice things to say about me. So he said, you always have to be above it. You never have to answer, never answer, never defend. It's not your job. And he was really a person of great magnanimity. It's the only word. There are many kosher organizations that I know in the United States today that he literally put into business. And he ran into a lot of flack for that too, because the Kashrus Committee and the Orthodox Union would say, Rabbi Rosenberg, how come we didn't have that answer? He would always have one answer for them. He said, they underbid us. But the deeper answer was that he really, he wasn't out to have every Hechsher in America. He wanted the other guy to live also. And since he knew that all of them were dependent upon him, were dependent upon the OU, they couldn't manufacture anything without it. So therefore, he really didn't care. He really wasn't troubled by it. He had standards, not just standards in kashrus, he had standards in behavior. I remember he told me, he said, I want to tell you, he said, you're in a difficult position because I mentioned before, three of the hotels were owned by members in our shul. So he said, I'm not worried about God forbid you would compromise the kashrus because of that. He said, but I don't know what to tell you. He said, the general rule is that no one that's affiliated with the OU is allowed to take any gift from the company, from the place. And he said, I enforce that rule. I remember once I had a terrible, embarrassing experience when I was the head of the OU that I brought a certain rabbi wanted to see the kashrus at a certain plant, and when I took him and he saw it and everything, when it was over, he asked the foreman to put a box of the product from the plant in the trunk of his car, which the foreman did, and I just didn't know what to say because it compromised everything that we were trying to do. So he said, but because you're the rabbi, he said, they're going to give you things not because you're the head of the kashrus here. They're going to give it to you because you're their rabbi. So he made rules for me. He said, I told him, I said, well, every year we get ices for Pesach from the one of the hotels. So he said, ices you can take for Pesach. He said, that's rabbinic. That's not the OU. But he said, whatever else, you're not allowed to take. And he himself lived up to it. Here's a man who millions of dollars went through his hands, literally millions of dollars. At the end, he died penniless. Nothing ever stuck to him. He was impervious to it. I have one of my favorite stories about him. Is that a Jew came to him once and he said that in order to get the certification from the OU, you have to go through a certain process. You have to fill out applications, then there had to be an inspection, then there was a rabbinic meeting, then there was a meeting of the Kashrus Commission. So it was a process that took 3, 4, sometimes even 6 months, depending how complicated it was. Sitting in the office. I was visiting with him in New York. I was still in Miami. I'm visiting with him in New York. And a Jew comes barging into the office. And he says to him in Yiddish, he says, yeah, I have to speak to Rabbi Rosenberg. So I get up to leave. So Rosenberg says, no, you stay. Right? So I'm like the fly on the wall observing this scene. And the Jew says to him, I'm opening this store, this plant tomorrow, and I have to have the OU. And I have to have the OU right away. I don't have 6 months. You know, they told me I have to fill out application and everything. He said, you know me, I know you, you trust me, it's not a problem. Rosenberg had a way of sitting that, you know, he folded his hands. He had this tremendously high forehead with his hat pushed back on his head, and his eyes were half closed, and he's sitting there, and the guy, Rosenberg, doesn't answer him, doesn't say a word. And the man persists. He says, Rabbi Rosenberg, I told you I have to have this. He says, I'll tell you what, he said, and I'm putting aside 5% of the stock in the corporation for you. You do whatever you want with it. Rosenberg sits like this. Nothing. Doesn't move a muscle. So the man says to him, 7%. Rosenberg, nothing. Zero. And I don't know what to make of this, right? He says, Rabbi Rosenberg, he said, the best I can do, the most I can do, I'll put aside 10% of the stock. So Rosenberg opens his eyes and looks at him, and he says in Yiddish, "Un was sagt Gott?" What would God say to this conversation? And that ended it. And all my life, that has stuck with me ever since, I heard it from Rosenberg's mouth, that if a Jew asks himself in moments of choice, of options, of even tests, and he asks himself, "Wo sagt Gott?" What will God say to this conversation? Rosenberg told me later that sometimes he lowers the level. He said, "Would you tell this to the IRS? Would you tell it to the Internal Revenue Service, to the tax man? Then don't tell it to me." But that was him. Wo sagt Gott? What does God say to this? Because he always was working for God. He wasn't working for any organization. He was working for God. He was working for the Jewish people. If it didn't fit into those parameters, then there was nothing to talk about. When the man left the office, so Rosenberg said, he'll never get the OU, no matter what he does, because in his heart, he thinks that he didn't offer me enough. So he said, and he told it to me regarding the hotels too, he said, we give the hechsher only because we trust the person. If you cannot trust the person, he said, in these kinds of businesses, he said, you put in 100 mashgichim, they'll cheat you anyway. The chef will run out of something, they'll run out in the middle of Pesach and buy it. Because he doesn't care. They'll get a new chef and he'll say the chicken soup is better with a little sour cream in it. And then the mashgiach is in the storeroom. So how are they going to happen? So he said the people that own the hotel, you have to be able to eat in their house. That's what he told me. And they have to have complete control. So if you trust them, then we can do it. If you don't trust them, you can't. And that's why under his reign, there were very few hotels that were OU. There were no tours that were OU. None of these things. Because he had that standard. He had that standard. And he told me many times that Procter & Gamble is Procter & Gamble because Procter & Gamble is an honest company. It's a moral company. They train their employees to be honest and moral. And when it goes wrong, they admit it. And therefore you can trust them in kashrus too. But he said, if that's not there, then he said, I don't have enough mashgichim in the world to control it. That was really a great insight. I have a second story about Rabbi Rosenberg, a story that I've told a number of times. I don't know if you've heard it. In 1974, after the Yom Kippur War, so there was the Arab oil boycott of the West. The oil boycott affected not only gasoline, but there were long lines in America, and it was a very, very tense period. It was an anti-Semitic period. There were bumper stickers that I saw that said, burn Jews, not gas, because it was all Israel's fault. And you remember Arafat came to the United Nations and put his gun on the table, and you know, and the whole world cheered. One of the casualties of the Arab oil boycott was the kosher glycerin industry. Kosher glycerin is kosher because it is made from fuel oil, crude oil. So in a barrel of oil, so the top 5-10% goes for airplane fuel, kerosene, airplane fuel. Then the next level goes for automotive fuel. Then the next level goes for diesel fuel. Then the next level goes for heating oil. 1, 2, 3, 4, the different levels. Then we're getting close to the bottom of the barrel where there's a lot of sludge already. So then that goes for vinyls and for plastics. The real bottom of the barrel goes for glycerin. That's what we eat. So the kashrus is dependent upon there being oil. And there were two companies in the United States that the OU had the certification. One company was Shell Oil in Texas, and the other was Procter & Gamble that had a glycerin plant on the West Coast. We had a company, the OU had a company called Mead Johnson, a big vitamin company in Indianapolis, Indiana. It made Polyvisol and Trivisol, which in the 60s and 70s and 80s was the vitamin of choice for infants. You know, they squirt it in the poor kid's mouth, right? And hope that he'll grow up big. And so the basic solution was 75% glycerin and 25% vitamins. The vitamins were in the glycerin solution. I remember I was sitting in the office one afternoon, and I get a call from the vice president at Mead Johnson in Indianapolis, and he tells me, Rabbi Wein, he said, we have a problem. He said, we have 100,000 labels printed with the OU. I cannot get another tank car of kosher glycerin. Nobody will sell it. My company, we always buy from Shell, and Shell has no more oil. I have to go and buy glycerin on the open market, which then it switched to tallow, to animal fat, non-kosher. And he said, I cannot reprint 100,000 labels. I can't close down the assembly line. He said, what can I do? So what, and I was thinking to myself, what am I going to do? I'm going to take big ads in the paper saying that that OU is unauthorized anymore. And I mean, it's just, you know, and you're dealing with a big company with Mead Johnson. And so I did the usual rabbinic response. I'll call you back. Don't answer off the cuff. So I call up Procter & Gamble, and I call up the vice president, Rosenberg's, who's, you know, who's still afraid of Rosenberg. Remember, Rosenberg had been dead then already 2 years. And I get him on the phone, and I say to him, you know, we have here a tremendous problem. And I explain to him, Mead Johnson called. They've got all these labels. They are not your customer. They may never be your customer again. But we're stuck with 100,000 labels that have the OU on it. And I said, can you sell them, four or six tank cars of kosher glycerin so they can get this 100,000 labels out of them, and then they'll print labels without the OU. So he says to me on the phone, there's a long pause. He says, if I do this for you, Rabbi, will Rabbi Rosenberg in heaven know that I did it? So by him, there's no doubt that Rosenberg's in heaven. And there's no doubt by him, this is, you know, he's a vice president of the company. He's not, you know, and there's no doubt that Rosenberg can put in a good word for him. So I told him, I said, you know, I can't really speak for heaven. But I said, if you do a good deed, you know, you help somebody in need, I mean, I'm certain that God counts it to your credit. And he sold him the six tank cars of glycerin at the regular price, and the truth happened that they never bought from Procter & Gamble again. They went back to Shell when Shell got oil. But then I saw Chazal say, "Gdolim tzadikim b'misosam yoser mibachayeyem," that righteous people, even after they're not in the world, their greatness many times is greater than when they're alive. He's still afraid of Rosenberg. And if Rosenberg will do something for him in heaven, then, you know. So that's what integrity buys for us. sense of correctness, a sense of what's good or not. He told me that in the DP camps, he met many people under terrible circumstances. And he said he met them later in life in New York, as I mentioned, under much better circumstances. Many of them had regained their faith. Many of them had new families. And he said that they used to come up to his office to talk to him, just to talk to him, because he said they had nobody to talk to. They couldn't tell their children or their new wife or their new congregation what they had experienced. And they certainly couldn't talk to them about the crisis of faith that they went through, because nobody wants to have, as a spiritual leader, somebody that admits that he has had doubts, even though, in my opinion, that's the only type of spiritual leader that one should have. Because the word faith presupposes that there's a moment of doubt, otherwise you don't need faith. So they had no one to talk to. So they come and talk to him. He said there would be days, he said, I spent hours in my office. I got nothing accomplished except people came in and talked to me. And they trusted him because they remembered him from the camps. And they trusted him because of his integrity. And they trusted him that whatever they said to him would remain with him, and that it was not dangerous to tell him any of these things, as perhaps it would be to tell it to other people who would use it against them. And when he passed away, and I about 6 weeks later, I inherited his job. So, as I mentioned, he passed away suddenly. And there were papers in his desk that we got to his family, etc., but there were OU papers in the desk. And he had scribbled on them in his handwriting, no charge, or needs special consideration, or he's a broken person. And because he had, as the chairman of the Kashrus Commission, another remarkable person by the name of Nathan K. Gross, he circumvented all of the pressures. You know, and when I took over, I saw there were a lot of people that were under the OU that really paid us nothing. And almost invariably, they were Holocaust survivors. And they were the people that he wrote in his notes, you know, no charge, or he's a broken person, or, you know, like, let it go. This is not where we're going to get the supplies from. And to do that, so he had to keep the organization going, so he explained to me, he invented the idea of private labels. Private labels is you walk into a supermarket in America, there's always a supermarket brand, which is a few cents cheaper. The supermarket brands all have the OU. Why do they all have the OU? Because they're made by the big company. The big company makes Sug Aleph the best under their name, Heinz Pickles. All right? And then the second grade pickles, they make Pathmark Pickles. But it's made in the same plant that are the same kosherous. So he... he created the idea that you could charge Pathmark a minimal amount of money to have the OU, and Pathmark would do it. He charged very little, I think $350 a year, but at the end of the year he had 1,000 such labels, which supported the little guy that he wrote no charge, or he's a broken man, or we're going to do it for him. And he had that vision. Really was a tremendous businessman, but he was a tremendous human being. He was always full of compassion. So you had this rare combination of a person of great wisdom, integrity, a great Talmud Chochem, a great scholar, and a person of, in the world, just great business acumen, and he could charm you that you could not say no. He just, you know, when he turned it on, you were through. You had no chance. And he used it only on behalf of the Jewish people. He used it only on behalf of establishing kashrus. So in this world, if we have, as we do now, such blessings of kashrus, you can go anywhere in the world and get OU products. My wife and I, we were once in Hawaii, you're in Alaska, you're in places that there's no Jew within 500 miles, right? And you, all the OU products are there. And because of this vision of the one person who saw how to do it and went ahead and did it, and I always felt, again, as I said at the beginning, that he imparted a great deal to me in terms of the view of a Jew, really a mentor, an example of how to be and how to behave and what type of vision to have in a very, very difficult field that often was compromised, and that he raised the standards to make it reliable the world over. I want to thank you for coming tonight. Next Tuesday, the lecture is on Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Kahaneman, the Ponovizh Rov, and it will be again at 8 o'clock. There'll be a minyan for Myriv now. Thank you.
He was a general. His son, I was a Talmud of Rev. Rosenberg. Yeah. He was actually a general in the army.
Yeah.
He told me a story how he was driving around in Himmler, Yimach Shemo's car, and he said the driver was a German beast that would run over the dog for no reason. He also told a story that some Nazi...